Introduction and Isaiah 1:1-9, the first talk in a series on the Book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on March 4, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to be starting in the book of Isaiah. I plan to march through it in probably 4 years. I've been wanting to do one of the prophets, and in particular, I find Isaiah intriguing. Of the prophets, it is the most quoted in the New Testament, and it's one of the three most quoted Old Testament books in the New Testament. And it is the book from which Jesus quotes on several occasions, in particular when he's in the synagogue, when he's at the beginning of his ministry. And I've always been intrigued to try to figure out what's going on in the prophets, how you understand the prophets. They've always been quite mysterious to me. And so I'm going to forge into it and hope that I can make sense of Isaiah. There are two other times that I've worked on Isaiah. One was in Reformation Fellowship two buildings ago. And I started into Isaiah, and I got about a dozen chapters into it and abandoned the effort because I didn't feel like I was making enough sense of the book to continue. And that's when I switched over to Genesis, and then I have marched through the narratives of the Old Testament in record time also. But I think now I'm ready to try it. I have learned a few things in the last 13 years, and I think looking at the Old Testament narratives will be helpful in looking at the prophets. The other experience I had working with Isaiah was about 4 years ago. It was a Bible study in our home that was kind of we jointly were working through the book. It took us 2 years. We started with 16 people, and by the end there were two. So it is a difficult book. It is a very difficult book. And the problem with the book is, and this is true with all of the prophets, it's hard to find the thread that strings it all together, the train of thought. It's not like reading an argument. And it's not like reading a historical narrative. It's a patchwork quilt of images. And I really think that the prophets are probably better suited to be interpreted by a poet rather than a historian. I am not a poet. Every year I write one poem just to prove that that's the case. But I think that this would be better suited for a poet, but I'm going to take it on nevertheless. Another problem is, to the extent that you can pick up on the themes readily, those themes keep recycling through, so it's quite repetitive. But I've come to see that in that repetition, each time the theme comes up again, it's looked at from a little different perspective, and it's expanded upon, and it's clarified. So there's a method to the madness. It is not just repetition, but there is development that takes place in the course of that repetition. The other thing that is tricky about Isaiah is that it seems to be such a downer, that there is, God keeps coming through saying, and this is going to happen, this bad thing is going to happen to you, and this the bad thing is going to happen to you because of your rebelliousness. But as I've looked at it, the book is actually, on the whole, quite comforting. And it starts out comforting as well, and I think that that's important because it's setting the tone for the whole book, that God is accomplishing good and loving purposes in the midst of all that happens. And it's important to keep track of that, and I will be reminding us on numerous occasions as we go through. So I think that I'm better placed now to make better sense of Isaiah, but it is a work in process, and we'll see how it goes. I am, despite the apparent repetition, and in spite of the kind of depressing undertone that does come through from time to time, there's a sense in which I am unapologetic in presenting Isaiah. I didn't write it. It was written by the prophet Isaiah under the instruction of God. So what's there is what God wanted to be there. And I will do my best to try to make that as clear as I can, what's going on in the book. But what it says is what it says, and what it says is for a good purpose. What I ask of you in this process is that you be active listeners. That will really help me, and I think it will help everyone else as well. I have not got this all worked out. I'm working it out as we go along. I'm a little bit ahead, but I'm working on it as we go along. I will not answer all the questions. There will be questions that will remain unanswered. But to the extent that you can raise questions, and to the extent that you can make observations and comments, I think that we will all benefit from that. I know that I will. So as I'm talking, as things come to you that are questions or observations, please jot them down. There'll be time at the end for questions and comments. I hope you'll make use of that. If you don't want to make use of that forum, you can talk to me afterwards, or you can send me emails during the week. But I would genuinely appreciate your observations, your comments, and your questions. Okay, an introduction to the book. The authorship of this book has traditionally been ascribed to the prophet Isaiah. As you're probably aware, biblical scholars have divided it up into two and sometimes three parts and have concluded that it was written by two or three different people. It has been in vogue for over 100 years to look for the disunity in the biblical texts, especially in the Old Testament. And on the basis of that 100 years of experience, I am confident that if you look for disunity, you will find it. The trickier thing is to look for unity and find it. And if the unity is there, you need to look hard before you abandon the effort. So I am going to proceed on the assumption that Isaiah was written by Isaiah, the whole thing. We will, when we get to chapter 39, notice that there is a significant break in the text. That's the observation that those who have divided it up into three authors have all made. And clearly there is a break in the text. There's no question about that. But the question, the more important question is, does that indicate a new author? And I will proceed on the basis that there is a unity that ties it all together. We'll see if that turns out to be true or not. So assuming that Isaiah is the author of the book and the whole book, who is Isaiah? Isaiah was a prophet who lived in the 8th century BC. We don't know a lot about him. According to Jewish tradition, he was a well-connected individual, well-connected to the court. In fact, his father was the son of the brother of the king of Israel, Amaziah, just before Uzziah. So very well connected in the court. There has been a bulla found, a little seal found, that has the name Amos written on it. And it was found in a context of several of these little bulas, which archaeologists have concluded they were around documents, and they sealed documents. And it was either the author of the scroll or whatever stamped that closed. The document has disintegrated, but the bulla remains, and there were several of them found in the same area, so it seems to have been a storage place for documents. One was found with the name of Amos on it, who is Isaiah's father. So it is possible that his father was a court official. We don't know that for sure, but that's a possibility. In any case, the text seems to indicate that Isaiah knows what people are thinking in the court. He is somehow well-connected, knows what they're thinking, what they're talking about, and what's going on. There is also a tradition in the Jewish tradition. It says that Isaiah died by being put in a log and sawn in half. We don't know that for sure, but there is a reference in Hebrews where it's talking about the experiences of some of the Old Testament prophets. And some of the experiences were good, some of the experiences were bad. I'll let you guess which category this fell into. But that could be verification of the Jewish tradition that Isaiah was cut in two. And if that happened, it probably happened under King Manasseh, who would have been the king right after Hezekiah. But other than that, we don't know anything about Isaiah other than what we read in the text. His prophetic activity spanned over the course of four different kings. It would appear that he began his prophetic ministry at the very end of the reign of Uzziah, and then continued through Hezekiah. Probably his prophetic activity ended during the time of Hezekiah. And then if the tradition is correct that he was put to death by Manasseh, that was the next king after Hezekiah, and that would have been when he was killed. If that's true, then his ministry spans about 50 to 60 years. So it's a very long time that he was a prophet. And if that's true, that could help explain why the text of Isaiah has some major breaks in it. It may have been written over an extended period of time. Different concerns, different issues, even the vocabulary then changes. I think if you were to think about writing a diary over a 60-year period of your life, I suspect that if we took something early and compared it with something late, it would be a significantly different style of writing. And that is what I think has happened here. Isaiah is clearly writing into the historical context in which he was living. He is interacting with the events that are happening with respect to Judah primarily in great detail. And as a result, it is necessary to know what those historical events are. I will be bringing that information in as it's appropriate as we work our way through Isaiah. But at the very outset, I think it's important for me to give a brief overview of the history of Israel leading up to this time, because all of that background is extremely important for understanding what Isaiah is doing. If we go way back, go back to the time of Abraham. So we're talking about 1800 BC approximately. God picked Abraham. We don't know why God picked Abraham. Abraham doesn't seem to have been outstanding in any particular respect. God just chose Abraham, and God blessed Abraham. And he told Abraham that he was going to take him to a land and give it to his descendants, and he was going to make his descendants as numerous as the sand in the sea. He also said that he was going to bless Abraham, and that he would bless those that blessed Abraham, and he would curse those that cursed Abraham. And so Abraham clearly becomes a significant figure in God's history of the world, a very significant figure. Abraham, God takes Abraham then to Canaan, to Palestine. A son is born to Abraham, Isaac, who inherits the promises from Abraham. Then Isaac has Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons. And that whole household, Jacob, the 12 sons, and all of their wives and children, go down to Egypt in order to escape the famine that has swept the land. They are in Egypt for over 400 years. During that time, they become enslaved by the Egyptian pharaoh and expand in numbers greatly, but are slaves to their Egyptian masters. At that time, God raises up Moses to lead them out of Egypt. And in the midst of a number of miracles, the plagues that God inflicts on the Egyptians, the parting of the Red Sea, the Israelites come through on dry land, the Egyptian army following after them enter in into the sea, and the sea closes in and drowns them. So it's a very dramatic beginning to the nation of Israel. One miracle after another. And then God leads them through the wilderness towards Canaan. And again, there are miracles that take place in the midst of that. He guides them with a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. He provides water miraculously. He provides manna out of the heavens miraculously. He provides quail for meat miraculously. So God is with them and acting very actively on their behalf as they go through the wilderness. But they get to the south end of Canaan, and God tells them to go in and take the land. But they send some scouts to look at the land, and they come back with reports that the Canaanites are big dudes, and we can't do it. We are not up to the task. And so God punishes them and sends them back into the wilderness for another 40 years before, once again, he brings them back to the doorstep of Palestine, this way by a different door. And under the leadership of Joshua, they go into the land and they conquer the land. Once again, when they go into the land, God miraculously parts the waters of the Jordan, and they walk through on dry land, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. Once they get into the land, God had told them to conquer and possess the land. There was an initial conquest by Joshua, but clearly there were lots of pockets within that land of Canaanites and Philistines. And those continued to be a source of difficulty for Israel for many years. Israel goes through a period of time, the period of the judges, during which Israel does not have an established leader, and they have no means of succession. Rather, God periodically will raise up an individual, and that individual will lead the Israelites against a particular foe in their midst. whether it's the Philistines or it's one some subset of the Canaanites. And that happens time after time, where a judge will be raised up who will lead them against one of their foes in their midst. The people tired of that. It was too precarious. It was too uncertain. They wanted to have a permanent leader and a means established by which they knew who their leader was going to be. They wanted to have a king like the neighbors. All the neighboring kingdoms had kings. They wanted one. God said, no, that's a dumb idea. But then God changed his mind. God relented and had Saul anointed by Samuel as the king of Israel. Saul looked like a great choice. He seemed to have all the qualities that you would want to have in a king. It just turned out that his heart was not devoted to God. He was rebellious. And in particular, he paid too much attention to the opinions of the populace, of the people. And so God chose another king. God had Samuel anoint David. And David became a very successful military commander within Israel. He gathered a following to him. That made Saul jealous. And as a result, David was driven from the court and went out into the wilderness, where he amassed a little army around him over a period of time, until Saul died. When Saul died, then David was proclaimed the king of Judah. So that's one tribe of Israel. In the rest of Israel, there was a civil war that took place. Didn't last very long. It was just 2 or 3 years. At the end of it, the only heir to Saul, to the throne, was killed. And at that point, then, the rest of Israel turned to David and proclaimed him to be king. So at that point, David became king of all of Israel, all of the tribes of Israel. Having been supported solely by the tribe of Judah, from which David came initially, there was clearly a certain amount of tension that developed within Israel. There was Judah, and then there was the rest of Israel. David tried very hard to smooth out that little difficulty, the tensions that existed there. And one of the things that he did in order to accomplish that was he established the capital just outside of the boundaries of Judah. So rather than having the capital in the territory of Judah, he moved it north to Jerusalem, which was basically a neutral site because it had not been under Israelite control until David came along and conquered it from the Jebusites. So he established his kingdom, its capital in Jerusalem, and he brought the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. Jerusalem then became the center of the kingdom of Israel. David's son, then Solomon, inherited the rule. And it was during the time of David and Solomon that Israel was at its greatest point of power and the greatest amount of territory that was under Israelite control. It was also quite prosperous, especially during the time of Solomon. But after Solomon died, his son Rehoboam was not real smart. And there had been grievances that were building up, and those grievances were voiced at the time that Rehoboam ascended to the throne after Solomon had died. And Rehoboam's response to those grievances, rather than to address those grievances, he just said to the people, tough. You still have to work. You You still have to work for me. You still have to pay your taxes. There are going to be no changes. And as a result, there was another civil war that developed. So Rehoboam became the king of Judah only. The rest of the kingdom split off under Jeroboam and became a separate kingdom. So from then on until the end of the two kingdoms, Israel has been divided into two parts. So it's Judah in the south and all of the other tribes, and usually it's referred to as Israel, in the north. Now, as we proceed through, I have a habit of referring to Judah sometimes as the southern kingdom and Israel sometimes by the northern kingdom. But don't be fooled. Those are synonymous terms. Judah and the southern kingdom are the same thing. Israel and the northern kingdom are the same thing. Okay? Just two different kingdoms that came out of Israel, out of the united Israel. So for about 200 years then, Israel exists as these two separate kingdoms. Rarely do they like each other. It's like a family feud. Rarely do they like each other. There are a few times when they are more or less cooperative one with the other, but that's relatively rare. There, most of the time, there is tension between the two kingdoms, and sometimes there is outright hostility between the two, and there is warfare between the two kingdoms. The kingdoms become quite different. Judah in the south is mostly desert land. There's not very much farmland. It's much smaller. It has a smaller population. It is not smack dab on the trade routes. As a result, Judah is by far the poorer of the two kingdoms. Israel, on the other hand, is much better off. It has some very good farmland. It has a much bigger population. It's right smack dab on the trade routes. So the northern kingdom, Israel, becomes much more prosperous. But it's away from Jerusalem. They understand that from the time of David and Solomon, that after the temple is built during Solomon, that becomes the center of the culture of all of the Jews. Well, what's the northern kingdom going to do? That's a problem, because maintains a very significant tie between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and one that could be problematic for the northern kingdom, for the rulers of the northern kingdom. As a result, they established their separate place of worship in Shechem eventually. So Shechem becomes the central place for their worship. Some kind of temple is built there. Offerings are given there. A priesthood is developed that is centered around Shechem. So we have the religion of Judah is centered in Jerusalem, around the temple in Jerusalem. The religion in the north is centered around Shechem, at the temple there and the priesthood that develops around it. The northern kingdom seems to be more prone to accepting outside influences, and as a result, the religion in the north, more than the south, although it's not unheard of in the south as well, the north kind of assimilates and it syncretizes. It takes bits and pieces from the religions of the surrounding peoples and combines it with its worship of Yahweh. And that brings us down to the time of Isaiah, the time of Uzziah, who is the king when Solomon, when Isaiah first begins to prophesy. Uzziah was the king of Judah when Judah reached its most prosperous period of time. And he fortified Judah. Judah was probably more secure than it had ever been since the kingdom divided. Uzziah, however, became rather arrogant, probably because of that success, and he insisted on being allowed to offer incense in the temple. That was forbidden for the king to do. Only the high priest could do that. But Uzziah wanted to do it, and he offered the incense in the temple, and immediately he got leprosy. And apparently served out the rest of his reign in a secondary position, that he was still king, but he couldn't perform in the ceremonies, and he was his power was somewhat restricted as a result of that. Then Uzziah dies, and that's an important period of time. It's in the mid 740s. I think he dies in 743. Is that right? 742. He dies in 742. At about the same time, Jeroboam the second, I think, in the northern kingdom died. So we have the king of the south and the king of the north both dying at about the same time. And way over in Mesopotamia, in Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser becomes the king of Assyria. Now, Assyria had been a world power many years earlier and then was in decline. But now, with Tiglath-Pileser, Assyria is going to reemerge as a world power and is going to want to expand its empire. And one of the directions it wants to expand is to the west. And when it goes to the west, that means going up to the northern part of the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia, and then south down into Palestine. So people don't really know that this is coming yet, but the signs will start to appear that there is trouble coming from the east. And we'll see that as we progress through Isaiah. But this event, the death of both the king of the north, the king of the south, and the advent of Tiglath-Pileser, all happening within a 2 or 3 year period of time, I think people sense that there is something momentous happening. I liken it to the Arab Spring, that you could sense that something momentous was happening. It's hard to tell what was happening. In fact, it's still hard to tell what's happening. But you get the sense that there is significant change happening and will continue to happen for the next few years. Well, that's the kind of atmosphere that was present at the time that Isaiah began to prophesy. Okay, we're going to look now at Isaiah chapter 1. Just as a brief introduction to this chapter, this section, the first 5 chapters, and maybe 6, I haven't quite decided yet, but hopefully I'll decide before we get there. The first 5 chapters, at least, appear to be an introduction to the book. And the main themes of the book are hit during these 5 chapters. And that this introduction, even itself, is rather repetitive, but it kind of goes in cycles. It'll introduce a theme, then go away from it and introduce another theme, but it'll eventually come back to that first theme and build on it and extend it, and it'll keep cycling through like that for five chapters. But all of the main themes that we will see in the rest of Isaiah, we'll see them here in the first 5 chapters. My suspicion is that this introduction was written kind of like I write introductions, just a little bit like I write introductions. That is, I usually write my papers before I write my introduction, because until I write my paper, I'm not sure what I'm going to say. And I suspect that that's the case here, that this introduction was actually written quite late. And there are a few indications in the introduction, I think, that point us in that direction. One indication of that is in the first verse, It says, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. He says it's a vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem. As we progress in Isaiah, it clearly also has to do with Israel, the northern kingdom. But the northern kingdom is not mentioned here. I suspect that's because the northern kingdom was gone at this point. By the time the introduction is written, the northern kingdom has ceased to exist. But we will see mentions of the northern kingdom later on. It says that it's a vision. Now, in the past, I have thought of prophets receiving visions as some kind of ocular phenomenon where they were actually seeing something like a dream or something like that. I have read a book by a rabbi by the name of Abraham Heschel. He was a rabbi who was born in Europe, moved to the United States, was trained as a rabbi. But then when he reached college age, he went to a university in Germany and studied primarily philosophy. And he is interesting in that he puts together his background in Judaism with some of the tools that he gained in studying Western philosophy. And I am very impressed with what he has come up with. He died in the 70s, I think, but he wrote a number of books, and one of them is called The Prophets. It's this book. I've read it. I'm going to have to read it again because it's full of stuff that's interesting, but I'm not sure that I fully grasp everything that he's saying. But his perspective is that he does not believe that, generally speaking, the prophets received a vision like some kind of movie that they're watching. That when it says a vision, it means that they had an experience, and this could be an experience over an extended period of time, but it's an experience in which they are overcome with this understanding and this keen feeling of how God sees his people. That all of a sudden, with clarity and keenness, he's able to look at his people the way that God looks at them and is overcome with that. It's not an ecstatic experience. It's more coming to a realization, coming to an understanding. He says that he describes it as not being passion. And what he means by passion is just a flood of emotion. But rather it's pathos. And what he means by that is it's having reflected on it and come to a full understanding, then having an emotional response on the basis of that understanding. And he refers to that as pathos. And he says, the prophets are filled with pathos. It's not fun being a prophet. It's agonizing because you are seeing things from God's perspective and feeling the agony that he feels and the anger and the compassion, all of that mixed together. The prophet is feeling all of that. And what he writes then comes out of that. I was looking for a few passages in this book that would kind of encapsulate what he's talking about and realized he doesn't encapsulate. It is very interestingly written. It's full of stuff that's thought-provoking, but it's just one thought-provoking thing after the other, and you have to put it together. You have to kind of synthesize, summarize. It's a little like the prophets in some respects. But I'm going to read just a few paragraphs to you as a sample of what he's talking about. To a person endowed with prophetic sight, everyone else appears blind. To a person whose ear perceives God's voice, everyone else appears deaf. No one is just. No knowing is strong enough. No trust complete enough. The prophet hates the approximate. He shuns the middle of the road. Man must live on the summit to avoid the abyss. There is nothing to hold except to accept God. Nothing to hold to except God. Carried away by the challenge, the demand to straighten out man's ways, the prophet is strange, one-sided, and unbearable extremist. Others may suffer from the terror of cosmic aloneness. The prophet is overwhelmed by the grandeur of divine presence. He is incapable of isolating the world. There is an interaction between man and God which to disregard is an act of insolence. Isolation is a fairy tale. Where an idea is the father of faith, faith must conform to the ideas of the given system. In the Bible, the realness of God came first, and the task was how to live in a way compatible with his presence. Man's coexistence with God determines the course of history. The prophet disdains those for whom God's presence is comfort and security. To him, it is a challenge, an incessant demand. God is compassion, not compromise, justice, though not inclemency. The prophet's predictions can always be proved wrong by a change in man's conduct, but never the certainty that God is full of compassion. The prophet's word is a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. One more passage. The words of the prophet utters are not offered as souvenirs. His speech to the people is not a reminiscence, a report, hearsay. The prophet not only conveys, he reveals. He almost does unto others what God does unto him. In speaking, the prophet reveals God. This is the marvel of a prophet's work. In his words, the invisible God becomes audible. He does not prove or argue. The thought he has to convey is more than language can contain. Divine power bursts in the words. The authority of the prophet is in the presence. His words reveal. There are no proofs for the existence of the God of Abraham. There are only witnesses. The greatness of the prophet lies not only in the ideas he expressed, but also in the moments he experienced. The prophet is a witness, and his words a testimony to his power and judgment, to his justice and mercy. I could read lots more, but you get a sense of the perspective that he is taking, and I have found it very helpful, very enlightening. Okay. In this first verse, it lists the four kings under which Isaiah was a prophet. Uzziah, I've already mentioned him. Jotham is not particularly noteworthy for our purposes right now. Ahaz is significant in that it's during the time of Ahaz that the pressure of Assyria coming from the east is beginning to be felt in Palestine. As a result, some of the kingdoms decide to form an alliance that is going to repel the attack from the Assyrians that they are expecting at any time. And that alliance is being formed by Aram and the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, as well as some other kingdoms. Judah, the kingdom of Judah, under Ahaz, has decided to opt out of that alliance. As a result, the northern kingdom and its allies decide that they are going to attack the southern kingdom. they are going to depose Ahaz and replace him with a king that will be willing to join the alliance with the other kingdoms. So Ahaz is scared to death. He expects this alliance to come and get him. Isaiah says, don't give in to it. Don't become a part of the alliance. Trust in God. Ahaz says, well, maybe I should ally with Assyria. God says, don't do that either. Trust in God. Ahaz allies with Assyria. And that's going to have significant consequences later on. Then Hezekiah becomes the king. Hezekiah is one of the best kings that Judah had. He restored the temple to the worship of Yahweh, and for the most part had a prosperous reign, but the storm clouds were beginning to gather to the east. So that's roughly the time period that Isaiah is a prophet. Okay, now let's launch into the text. Starting with verses 2 and 3. Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner and a donkey its master's manger, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. This is going to introduce the main theme that we see coming back and built on in this introduction and then into the rest of the book. He starts out by calling on the heavens and the earth to listen. It's interesting that he would call upon them to listen to what he has to say. Why would he call upon them? Because back in Deuteronomy, when God made the covenant with the people of Israel, he called heaven and earth to be witnesses to this agreement that he was making with, this covenant that he was making with the people of Israel. And now he's calling them in as witnesses to see how things have gone. And things have not gone well. There are several times when this is referred to in Deuteronomy, the heavens and the earth are called in as witnesses. But I'm going to read the Song of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy. It's Deuteronomy 32. I'm going to read the whole song. It's lengthy, but because there are so many themes in there that we will see over the next few weeks, I think it's worth reading through the whole thing. So Deuteronomy chapter 32, I'm going to read verses 1 through 43. Give ear, O heavens, and let me speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as the droplets on the fresh grass and as the showers on the herb. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God, the Rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are just. A God of faithfulness and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. They have acted corruptly towards him. They are not his children because of their defect, but are a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is not he your father who has bought you? He has made you and established you. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father, and he will inform you. Your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of man, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of a wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He guarded him as the pupil of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young. He spread his wings and caught them. He carried them on his pinions. The Lord alone guided him, and there was no foreign god with him. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, and he ate the produce of the field, and he made him suck honey from the rock, and oil from the flinty rock, curds of cows and milk of the flock, with fat of lambs and rams, the breed of Bashan and goats, with the finest of the wheat, and of the blood of grapes you drank wine. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not God, to gods whom they have not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth. And the Lord saw this and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. Then he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a perverse generation, sons in whom there is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is not God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger and burns to the lowest part of Sheol and consumes the earth with its yield and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap misfortunes on them. I will use my arrows on them. They will be wasted by famine and consumed by plague and bitter destruction. And the teeth of beasts I will send upon them, with the venom of crawling things of the dust. Outside the sword shall bereave, and inside terror, both young man and virgin, the nursling with the man of gray hair. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. I will remove the memory of them from men, had I not feared the provocation by the enemy, lest their adversaries should misjudge, lest they should say, our hand is triumphant, and the Lord has not done all this. For they are a nation lacking in counsel, and there is no understanding in them. Would that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would discern their future. How could one chase 1,000 and put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up? Indeed, their rock is not like our rock. Even our enemies themselves judge this, for their vine is from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison, their clusters bitter. Their wine is the venom of serpents and the deadly poison of cobras. Is not laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries. Vengeance is mine, and retribution in due time their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. For the Lord will vindicate his people, and will have compassion on his servants. When he sees that their strength is gone, and there is none remaining, bond or free, and he will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they sought refuge? Who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their libation? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your hiding place. See now that I am he, and there is no god besides me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal, and there is no one who can deliver from my hand. Indeed, I lift up my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired leaders of the enemy. Rejoice, O nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land and his people. All of the themes that he's going to go through in this introduction are all contained in there. And that Song of Moses is to a certain extent prophetic in that it predicts that the people of Israel will betray the covenant that God made with them and betray their God and turn to idols. And that's going to be a major theme that shows up here. But in the end, God will redeem them. God will save them. It's interesting, Isaiah, the word Isaiah, the name Isaiah means Yahweh saves. And there's a sense in which that is the keynote of the entire book, is that God and only God, Yahweh and only Yahweh, saves. So I think that that's why Isaiah refers to the heavens and the earth as being that to which they need to come as witnesses and testify to what has happened. Then Isaiah uses his first image, that is, of sons who have been reared and brought up, and then they have revolted against their father. That is a really important image here, that the relationship between God and Israel is the kind of relationship that a father has with his sons. That is to say that those sons are individuals that the father has poured his life into. He has cared for them. He has protected them. He has trained them, even disciplined them. Disciplined them so that they would reach the point of maturity where they can embrace and live on the values of the father, the values that he has instilled in them. But for those sons then to reach the point of maturity and rebel against their father has to hurt deeply. That has to be a major blow. And yet that's what has happened with respect to Israel. The descendants of Abraham have, even though they've been nurtured by God, have revolted against him. The next image then in verse 3 is with respect to an ox and a donkey who, even though they are just dumb animals, they know where their food comes from. The farmer feeds them. I think that this verse is proof that they didn't have chickens in Israel. Because chickens are dumber. And yesterday I was working in the yard, and the chickens were out, and they followed me everywhere because they wanted me to feed them. Later on, they went into the barn, and I scared them, and because they thought I was coming in to kill them, I'm sure. And they're all saying, "Run for your life!" But they got behind some fencing, and then they couldn't get out. All they had to do is walk around it. But the idea is clear, and that is, these are dumb animals. But even dumb animals know where their food comes from. Even dumb animals are smart enough to know who takes care of them. And yet, the people of Israel, they don't know that. They don't know that it's God that takes care of them. That's an important theme, and the introduction is going to develop that, and it's going to be significant. Verse 4. Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly. They have abandoned the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. As a result of their rebelliousness, Isaiah now is referring to them as a sinful nation. Alas, a sinful nation. The alas part is he's feeling it. He's seeing it from God's perspective and feeling it. Sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, that their rebelliousness has actually created a burden on them. And Isaiah is able to perceive that. They themselves may not perceive it, but there is a burden that has developed as a result of their iniquity. And I think I suspect we all know, we've seen that phenomenon. I remember when our children were young, there would be times when they would do something kind of borderline naughty. And if we didn't punish them, it was not uncommon for them to go on then and do something else borderline naughty, maybe even a little worse, and maybe something even a little worse, until we would discipline them. And there's a sense in which that was a relief, that they sensed relief from that because they're kind of losing control of themselves. I worked in a institution for, it was a medium security institution for juvenile delinquents in the state of Washington with my oldest brother. And the head counselor in the lodge where I was working, he helped me figure out what I was supposed to be doing and how to think about what I was doing. And he said a number of things that were very significant in my thinking and have stuck with me. But one of them was, these young men, they're the teenage boys, young boys, he said, they read control as love. He said, they are like a young teenager is like, it's like taking a little kid and putting him behind the steering wheel of a semi-truck. And it's careening down the freeway. And the problem is, they know they can't control it. And they need help. And the best thing that you can do is come alongside them and help put constraints on them and control. And they will interpret that as love. Especially when it's done out of their best interest. They really understand that as love as it is. And that has stuck with me. I think that that is true. I think that's very true. That when rebelliousness, there's a sense in which rebelliousness begets rebelliousness, and it becomes a burden eventually. A kind of picture of that is an addiction, whether it's to drugs or to alcohol. At the beginning, the person who is taking thinks they're in control of the situation. But it's not long before they are clearly not the one in control of the situation. It's the drug itself that's taken over and is a burden. Alas, sinful nation, people weighed down with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who act corruptly. They have abandoned the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away from him. Two phrases here, abandon the Lord. That word for abandon is the same word in Hebrew that's used for divorce. So they have separated themselves. They have divorced themselves from the Lord. And the phrase in the last clause, they have turned away from him. That turned away has the connotation of turn away towards idols. That's usually the context in which that word is used. So that's kind of hinting at what we're going to see developed later, that it's idolatry is one of the main issues here. And we'll see that pop up in a couple of chapters. Verses 5 and 6. Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is nothing sound in it. Only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil. So the picture here is this body that has been slashed and beaten, and there is no place left on it untouched by blows. And all of these seem to be injuries inflicted by blows, typically the kinds of injuries that would be found in warfare. So it's kind of conjuring up something like a warrior that has been thoroughly thrashed. There has been, no one has cared for the wounds. The wounds have gone uncared for. And the first question is, where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? So from God's perspective, it's, I don't want to inflict more pain. There's no delight in inflicting more pain, but you continue in your rebellion. What do I do? Then verses 7 through 9. Your land is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your fields, strangers, are devouring them in your presence. It is desolation, as overthrown by strangers, and the daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a watchman's hut in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Unless the Lord of hosts had left us a few survivors, we would be like Sodom, we would be like Gomorrah. So this is our fourth little image. As you can see, and this continues through the book, it's like a mosaic of little images. And as the reader, you have to put those pieces of the mosaic together for the picture to emerge. This is the fourth little image that he's using. And it's one of Judah being likened to a little hut in a cucumber field, where that's all that's there. There's just this hut. It's not a house, it's a hut. It's just a little shelter, very precarious, isolated all by itself. There's nothing around it but cucumber field. And the fields are being devoured by strangers. And it starts out, your land is desolate, your cities are burned with fire. So the image seems to be one in which Judah has been subjected to an invasion. The land is desolate. Everything's been burned by fire. All that's left is probably Jerusalem, and I'll talk about that in just a second. Probably Jerusalem is all that's left, and it's like the little hut in a cucumber patch. And there's nothing but strangers eating the fields round about. And the people of Judah are in Jerusalem, quivering and shaking because they don't have a substantial building to hide themselves in. I suspect that this is reference to the invasion of the Assyrians in 701. In 701, the Assyrians sweep in. So this is after the northern kingdom has already been conquered by the Assyrians 20 years earlier. And the Assyrians have taken much of the population of the northern kingdom and shipped them into other parts of the Assyrian Empire. But Assyria comes back because Judah stopped paying tribute to Assyria under Hezekiah. And so the Assyrians come in and they conquer almost all of the cities of Judah except for Jerusalem. And they besiege, but they besiege Jerusalem. And then, inexplicably, the Assyrian army departs during the night. And when we get to that, we'll talk more about it. It's a fascinating little event because we have the Assyrian version of what happened written in documents that still exist. But I think that that's what this is referenced to, that it's talking about that situation in which there was nothing left but Jerusalem in all of Judah. And the Assyrians were rampaging the rest of the country, and the people of Judah could look out from Jerusalem and see it all happening. There's nothing they could do about it, and their situation was extremely tenuous. So that's the nature of some of the discipline that God has dished out to the people of Judah because of their rebelliousness. But their rebelliousness is on an equal to that of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, that's implied here. We would be like Sodom, we would be like Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah were the epitome of rebelliousness and wickedness. And as a result, God destroyed them completely except for Lot and his family. Judah's sinfulness and wickedness is comparable, and their fate was nearly the same had it not been that God chose to leave a remnant. And we'll keep coming back to that remnant that God chose to preserve. That's another theme that will keep coming up throughout the book of Isaiah. Okay, I don't have much time left. I want to hit on the main themes here. The first theme that I want to talk about is that Israel, and Judah in particular, has taken for granted the care that God has provided for them. that Isaiah is asking them, why do you not recognize what God has done for you? All that he has done for you, and that what he has done for you is extensive. And why don't you recognize that and therefore relate to him as the one who cares for you and takes care of you? As I've thought about this, what are the kinds of things that Isaiah is thinking about that they should reflect on, that it would be good for them to reflect on? The first thing, I think, is historical information. That the history of Israel is full of stories about things that God has done in a very overt fashion to take care of his people, Israel. In particular, with respect to the Exodus and the period in the wilderness. God doesn't always act overtly in history. For the most part, God is in the background. At least that's my perspective. God lets things appear to kind of run their natural course. He doesn't act in a way that is clearly God acting very often. But there are some times in history when he has chosen to do so. And the Exodus, I think, is probably example number one, because that is one that's referred to throughout the Old Testament as well as the New Testament as evidence of God's activity in the life of the nation of Israel. And I think Isaiah is trying to encourage them to reflect on that history. Israel has a unique history in that respect, a history that none of the other nations of the world have. But the Israelites of all people have the opportunity to reflect on God's goodness towards them. The second thing is a kind of general care that God provides for everybody. That we all enjoy air to breathe, water to drink, a heart that keeps beating. And those are all the gift of God. Were it not for his provision, those things would not happen. It's that kind of provision that he makes for all people, not only all people, but the birds of the field enjoy that same kind of provision from God. The third kind of thing that I think they're supposed to reflect on is God's personal interaction with us. And I think that it is the case that God carries on that personal interaction with all of us in a way that we can probably see it. I'm going to give you one example from my life, but I suspect that all of you have similar kinds of things. And this is relatively trivial in some senses, but it's always been very significant to me. When Susan was pregnant with our fourth child, I remember vividly one day when she was about 5 months into it that she sat down on the end of the bed and was crying. And she said, "The baby's got Down syndrome." And I thought, oh my goodness, how would you know that? I mean, in fact, he was the first of our babies that was tested for, they were just starting to use those screening tests to see if people had, to see if babies had Down syndrome, and he tested negative. So I sat down with her and I kind of went through this. Well, there was a test done and it was negative, and yes, the pregnancy has been a little unusual, because it had been a little unusual, and Susan sensed that keenly. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem. And there's nothing we can do about it, even if the child does have Down syndrome. So we will just proceed, and we'll see what happens. Well, at the hospital, when Seth was born, he looked normal. And so as soon as the doctors step aside, one of the first things I said to Susan is, well, at least he doesn't have Down syndrome. And the next morning, then the doctor informed us that he did indeed have Down syndrome. And as soon as Susan heard that, we were both in tears. But one of the first things that she said to me was, one of the hardest things in dealing with this is no one will ever say, what a cute baby. What was so striking about that is we never had a baby that people so often said, what a cute baby. Now, on the one hand, that's trivial, but on the other hand, it is so significant that God would relate to us in such a personal way, it seems to me. And I could list probably a dozen of events that are similar, that really have what I think of as the fingerprints of God on them. That it really has God's touch that's happening there, that's communicating to us that God is indeed in control of things and he does indeed care for us individually, personally. The problem is we forget them so soon. It is so easy to lose track of those. As life gets difficult, it's so easy to lose track of those kinds of things. I think it's very interesting that when the Israelites crossed the River Jordan, they walked on dry land, and before the water closed in on the path that they came across, Joshua instructed the heads of each of the tribes to pick up a stone from the bottom of the river, and they were going to pile it up as a memorial. It's important for us to not forget the things that God has done for us, because it's so easy to take God for granted and lose sight of the things that he has done and the gracious way that he has cared for us. The second thing I'll point out, and I will do these last two very quickly. One is, I think that the image of a father and sons is a very helpful one in illuminating the situation with respect to God and the nation of Israel. We all know that it is really easy for children to take for granted what their parents do for them, especially the younger they are. There is so much that parents do for children that is completely lost on them. They don't even recognize that it's happening. As they grow older, they become somewhat more aware of that, but probably even much later, they don't recognize fully what their parents have done for them. So I think this is the same kind of phenomenon with respect to Israel, and it's taking God for granted. Another part of that is to recognize that discipline is a significant part of how a father relates to the children. And it's hard for the children to understand, at least initially, what that discipline is and how that plays a role, how that can be good. How can I have a good father who spanks me? But when it's put into the context of all that a father does, I think that becomes apparent, and even a child understands that and grows to appreciate that. Okay, and then just lastly, I want to just point out that notice the tone in this opening part of Isaiah is not primarily punitive. It's primarily a pleading. It's asking Israel, please respond. Please recognize what's going on and change your ways. I don't want to inflict more pain. Like a father, you often hear the expression, this will hurt you more than it does me. As a father, that's really true. There's no delight in punishing a child. And yet, discipline needs to happen for a greater good. And so that's the context in which this all of this is placed. And we need to remember that that's the context in which it's placed. Okay, I have gone over, so I won't take questions this time, but please, if you have questions, write them down, and we'll have time next week. Thanks.